Did I tell this class why it's always important to say bless you or something when they sneeze?
No.
You did?
All
right. I don't want you to be a soulless dead being, so. Cruel.
Trevor has done. Cool, cool, cool. All right, boys and girls, it's time to get rolling. We did that. This is where we left off. All right, let's get the brain working here. Okay, so we got a situation.
We are on the path to one of the most significant events in Western civilization, World War I. And of course, if you appreciate, the reason why World War I occurred was because of new imperialism. All of the nations fighting over territory to get resources. Wealth
and power. Which coincidentally was the same thing that motivated the kings back during the Age of Exploration. More land, more money, more power. But, of course, the difference was, is by the end of the 19th century, you had powerful industrial economies, modernized military capability. Capacity to kill lots of people. But, as we said, after the conclusion of the Franco-Prussian War, diplomacy reigned supreme. A lot of the diplomacy was through the brilliance of Otto von Bismarck, the Iron Chancellor. So, in order to prevent war between in Europe, he came up with his strategies utilizing real politic to prevent war by keeping France by itself and trying to hold the hands of Austria and Russia. Unfortunately, as we left off toward the end of class, a war broke out between the Russians and the Ottomans, and the Tsar got mad and bailed on the Three Emperors League. So, that set to possibly undo Bismarck's plan. But of course, that's what he created the dual alliance to counter. Now, the problem was his ally, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which, of course, as you can see on this map, encompasses much of the modern nations of Austria, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, good chunk of Poland, as well as the modern state of Croatia, and Bosnia, with Herzegovina in there. However, unlike France, which was full of French, unlike Germany, which was full of Germans, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was what is known as a supranationalist empire. A supranationalist empire. Meaning, it was a nation where minorities ruled over other minorities. There was no true majority population. Interestingly enough, this empire in the 1880s only had one ruler, Franz Joseph, who had been ruling it since 1848. He was born in 1830. So by the 1870s and 1880s, he is getting up there in age. But, unlike many supranationalist nations, the weird thing about The Austro-Hungarian Empire is in the name. It wasn't just one minority ruling over all of the ethnic minorities. No, 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 no. It was an alliance between two minorities
who ruled over everybody else. The Austrians were German. The Hungarians were descendants of the people who migrated into Europe under the leadership of Attila.
The Huns.
Two culturally, racially different peoples. But they made a grand alliance and they ruled over all of the different colored areas, which contained Czechs and Slovaks and Poles and Ukrainians and Slovenes and Croats and Serbs and Romanians and Italians and Ruthenians.
All of these people had their own culture, their own language, their own traditions. But they were subverted by the two ruling groups.
And beginning in the 1860s,
bless you again, welcome, Franz Joseph's government became a police state.
They didn't have policemen. No, they used their soldiers. And whenever one of the ethnic minorities protested, demanded more rights or more recognition, the soldiers went in and used force. And the more the minorities pushed, the more force that was used, creating a snowball effect, always requiring more and more and more. Now, ironically, the minority groups were being pumped up by Serbia.
Serbia, Slavic people, middle of the Balkan Peninsula, encouraged all of the ethnic minorities to rebel, to break away from the Austro-Hungarian rule. Because tiny little Serbia wanted its own empire.
They wanted to take all of the different minority groups and merge them together to create a Slavic kingdom, a greater Serbia.
Arguing, yes, they would still be under the control of a monarch, but at least it's the same broad ethnic, racial, cultural group. Now the problem is right here, the Croats and the Serbs, and right here, Slovaks, had about 7 million people in it. And again, racially, culturally, they're closer to the Serbs than they are the Austrians or the Hungarians. If they were to break away, the Austro-Hungarian economy would be shattered. Millions of people would leave, hundreds of thousands of acres of land gone. Resources, factories, you name it. That would be like if the United States split apart and never was rejoined after the Civil War. We would have never became a superpower. So, fearing secession, the Austro-Hungarians used more and more force.
To make matters worse, going back through time, the Austrians had always been rivals with Russia.
they were in competition of sorts. From the Russian perspective, the Russians also wanted the same piece of pizza. They too wanted to come down and take control over the Balkans, because again, we've already talked about the freshwater port. Now, unlike the Austrians and the Hungarians, who were Catholics, the majority of the Croats and the Serbs and so forth, they were Greek, well, they were of the Orthodox faith. Greek Orthodoxy is very similar to Russian Orthodoxy. So while the Russians were a different race than these people, they had the one thing in common. So now you have a situation where the Austrians want this land, the Serbians want this land, oh, and the Russians want this land. Needless to say, the Austrians believed they were in a struggle for survival. That any event could be cataclysmic. So the Austrians needed to fight with all its strength. Questions? All right. Well, when word spread to Russia that Germany was essentially making an alliance with one of its great rivals, that kind of put the fear into the new Tsar. Tsar Alexander II. Now, FYI, one of the reasons why he was fearful, his father, Tsar Alexander I, had been assassinated. A group of assassins targeted the Tsar when he was going through St. Petersburg in his carriage. And they threw several grenades under his carriage. Well, his carriage apparently was bomb-proof, so when it blew, it broke the axles of the carriage. But one of the grenades had a delayed timer. So when the bomb went, boom, the carriage broke, the Tsar gets out, staggering. The next bomb went off and blew him to bits. Which, of course, made his son terrified that there could be assassination plots everywhere. So he decided to reverse his father's decision and come back into the Three Emperors League. Three Emperors League, in its second incarnation, would last until 1887. So now, simultaneously, gotta do the mental math, Bismarck has the dual alliance with Austria, while at the same time, it has the Three Emperors League. Eastern Europe is secure. But a weird thing occurred shortly after the Reformation or reformation of the Three Emperors League. In 1882, Italy contacts Bismarck and asks for the ability to join the dual alliance. Now, FYI, Italy itself was a new country. Italy was created in 1871. Italy previously had been like Germany, a whole bunch of little states. If memory serves me correctly, I think there were 14 separate ones. But in 1871, they had a nationalist movement, and all of the states agreed to join together. the first king of Italy was crowned. He would die, and his son, Umberto, would become king in 1878. Well, Umberto saw what was going on with the agreement between the Kaiser and the Kaiser, the German Kaiser and the Austrian Kaiser, and he decided he wanted to get in for similar reasons. Except Umberto wasn't afraid of Russia. No, 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 no. Umberto was afraid of France. Italy, I should have a map, but I don't. Italy shares a small border with France. But during the age of new imperialism, Italy is trying to take territory in North Africa just at the same time France is. So, you now have a situation where you have another nation that's on the verge of going to war against France, which Bismarck does not want to allow to have happen. So, he brings Italy in, and he creates the same defensive thing that I mapped out on Tuesday. If France were to attack either Germany or Italy, the other would jump in. But if anyone else attacked, they could declare neutrality.
Should be in your notes, because I put it on the board.
If not, you're going to have to listen to the way I explained it on the recording, or get the notes from somebody else. Well,
with the linking of pretty much all of the powers in Europe, Bismarck's alliance system goes into full effect.
Italy, Austria-Hungary, Germany become part of what would soon thereafter be known as the Triple Alliance. Plus, Germany, Austria, and Russia are in that loose-knit friendship group. What the heck did I do? That loose-knit friendship group, which we shall refer to as... I don't even know that one. Okay, we did that one. No, we didn't do that one. No, here we go. Known as the Three Emperors League. And France is all by itself, has no friends. Oh, but wait, 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 wait. What about Great Britain? Well, here's the amazing thing. This is where knowing history helps. Going all the way back to 1822, England had enough of European politics. So since 1882, England stopped paying attention to what was going on in the continent, particularly after the destructive Napoleonic Wars. England instead was working on building a global empire. So, what England as a policy from the 1820s all the way up into the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, they practiced what was regarded as splendid isolationism. In other words, they're only worrying about themselves. They don't care what else is going on, because in their world, everything is hunky-dory. Although, truth be told, after the Franco-Prussian War and how easily Germany defeated France, England was kind of concerned. But Bismarck, continually using diplomacy, contacted England and basically said, we're not going to threaten your global empire. Our goal was to bring the 26 German states together, and that's all we're going to do. So, reassured, England went back to worrying about their own empire. So,
Bismarck managed to basically do the human twister. He had his hands on all the dots of all the different colors. He had everything contained just like he wanted to.
All of the powers were aligned to him or were just not paying attention, and France was by itself, which meant no war. Perfect. For 5 years, everything went fine. But does anything last forever? Fortunately, in 1887, world events caused the perfect system, or rather the system perfected by Bismarck, to begin to crack. Tensions began flaring between the Austrians and the Russians over events that were going on in the Balkans, which we will talk about. Not quite yet, though. And, as a result, Russia once again bailed on the Three Emperors League. This was a huge potential blow, because if war broke out on the Eastern Front, Bismarck was still terrified Germany could fall apart. So, he went into diplomatic overdrive. Through secret channels, he worked with the Russian foreign minister. And he would negotiate what became known as the reinsurance treaty. The reinsurance treaty. Now, this was a secret treaty, just like all of them, but it was critical. In it, Bismarck got Russia to agree to a state of neutrality if either got into a war. So if Germany went to war with anybody, Russia would be neutral. If Russia went to a war with anybody, Germany would be neutral. With two exceptions. If Germany was attacked by France, or if Russia was attacked by Austria, then either could enter the war if they chose. Kind of a little different than the Triple Alliance Agreement. I'll say it again.
Under the reinsurance treaty, if war erupts between Germany or Russia or anybody else, neutrality. They would not get involved. But if a war erupted between Germany and France, or Russia and Austria, then the other could enter and help if they wanted to.
Now, by the way, this was huge, potentially for both. Germany also agreed that they would back any Russian attempt to get Bulgaria from the Ottoman Empire. And that Germany would join with Russia if anyone tried taking control of the Black Sea. Do we get all that? Okay. So what does this mean? Well, we once again ratcheted down peace.
For 2 years. Because in 1888, events went beyond Bismarck's ability to control.
On March 9th, 1888, death occurred.
The first Kaiser of Germany, Wilhelm I, dies
at the ripe old age of 90. Wilhelm, as King of Prussia, was the man who hired Bismarck in 1860. Wilhelm was the man who put undue trust into Bismarck. And as Iron Chancellor of Prussia, used Realpolitik to manipulate events to achieve unification. And as Kaiser, Wilhelm I allowed Bismarck to dictate German foreign policy for nearly 18 years. But now the emperor was dead. But fortunately, he did his kingly duty. FYI, guys, not so much the gals, but guys, if any of you ever become kings, there's only one thing that you need to worry about above all else. Heirs. Because if you have no kids, your family gets kicked off the throne. But fortunately, Wilhelm did. His oldest son, Frederick, who was technically Frederick I of Germany, but more precisely, he's regarded as being Frederick III of Prussia, would become King of Prussia and German Kaiser. All right. Now, interestingly enough, the prince was raised in true Prussian tradition. He was a aristocrat who embraced monarchy and militarism. But he would have a transformation in life. His attitudes would change.
Because he experienced shock with his own eyes. Something I hope none of you ever have to experience. He fought in the Franco-Prussian War. Unlike TikTok videos and video games and all the other goofy things that us in America get to waste our times doing, he went into combat. He killed men on the battlefield. He saw death.
And he had an extraordinary transformation, we'll just say. And by the way, this is true of many men who go into combat. They come out different. He decided, after the war, that this whole monarchy thing, this whole desire for absolute power, was ridiculous. Instead, he became a classical liberal. He liked what was going on in England. He, for example, argued that the German Constitution, which was created by Bismarck to give the Chancellor
and the monarch complete power over Germany should be changed to like what England has still today, where there is a king, but the king is just a figurehead. But power is held by Parliament. Parliament is the legislative branch, and it's part of the executive branch. And it's controlled by the will of the people through elections. So people vote their delegates, they go into Parliament, the Parliament passes law, and the Prime Minister, who is chosen from the Parliament, enforces the law. He basically said that the German people should have a say. Which, needless to say, was not too good in Bismarck's eyes. But what could he do? He was Kaiser. Well, until fate stepped in. Three days before the death of his father, Frederick, who used to smoke cigars nearly every moment of his waking day, always had a cigar in hand, always smoked. He chain smoked cigars. He, 3 days before the death of his father, was diagnosed with throat cancer. And guess what they didn't have in 1888? They didn't have chemotherapy. So when the cancer was discovered, he had to go under the knife, and the surgeons botched the surgery, severed and caused permanent damage to his vocal cords, and didn't go in with clean hands, resulting in a massive infection in his throat. The poor guy would die of sepsis. Well, during his 99-day reign, he did nothing other than get crowned King of Prussia. He never even fully went through the coronation process to become emperor because he was too sick. And he accomplished nothing other than death. Oh. But prior to that, he did his kingly duty. And he had a son, Wilhelm II. All right. And here is where the problem lies. Because when the new emperor was crowned, the new emperor had his own ideas on how things should be run. And let me tell you, he had little interest in following the ideas of real politic and controlled policy because he was young and he was ambitious, and can I say this in a nice way, he had psychological issues. Alright, when he was crowned, he was 29 years old. He was an adult. But
because in 1888, when he was crowned, he was born in 1863. So he was born prior to Germany. But by the time he was 10, Germany was already in place. So he knew nothing, because he was a child, of the struggle that went into creating Germany. He was born into success. And I'm going to use having a brain fart. Come on, get it. Oh, Hunter Biden. There we go. I couldn't think of his first name.
Here's Joe Biden's son as an example. Although you can use any young kid who's born to a powerful, wealthy, successful father.
Kids don't know what it takes to become successful because they inherit the wealth. And as a result, they grow up to be spoiled. They're entitled. But you really can't see it on this picture, but if I can remember when a couple of more pictures come up, I'll point it out. He also was handicapped. Any of you know what Erb's palsy is? ERB, Erb's. Erb's palsy. Well, when you out of your mother, yeah, your mother's birth canal, you know, can expand and kind of squeeze you out. But in order for you to be squeezed out properly, you have to basically be head first, and your arms have to be by your side, and your legs have to be pointing this way. If the baby does not come out that way, bad things could happen. So, for example, when my son was getting close to out of my wife, it was discovered, thank God they have ultrasound, it was discovered that he was breech. He was upside down. So if he popped out, he would have gone bum first, which meant in all likelihood, his legs would have gone up, would have shattered his pelvis, probably would have died, and the bones would have been exposed and would have ripped open my wife, and I probably would have lost both. But thank God for modern medical science, because she got C-section. So they went in and they cut him out. Well, they didn't have ultrasound when William was born. So as he was being pumped through the birth canal, his arm was up. And his arm was broken. And as a result of that injury, it never healed, because you can't mend bones with babies. And the damage was permanent. When he reached adulthood, his left arm, this arm, was 6 inches shorter than his right. So whenever he had his picture taken, he always had optical illusions. Because if I have a dark shirt and I'm sitting like this, you can kind of tell, right? You can kind of tell, okay, there's one arm. Or if I went like this, my arm was straight, you could tell the difference. So what he always did, he would not let anyone take his picture unless his hand was in a white glove, usually with a white sleeve, so it could blend all in color-wise, and his left hand was always on the, actually this is my left hand, left hand was always on the pommel of a sword. So in other words, if you see somebody with 6 inches less, you think, okay, his elbow is just back, not realizing it's actually his arm fully extended. But imagine being an alpha male, the prince, the heir apparent, and being handicapped. Well, at an early age, he started becoming a bully. I mean, after all, unlike me, when I was a kid and I had my little army men, you know, I'd go out in the sandbox and that'd be fun. He actually had adult human being soldiers that he could play war with. But there was a chance, because Bismarck was heavily involved in his education. When Wilhelm turned 20, knowing that the end of his grandfather was coming, and one day his father would become Kaiser, Bismarck actually had his own son, Herbert, become the personal tutor of Wilhelm. So for 9 years, he received training on what Bismarck was doing, on all types of foreign and domestic policy. But Wilhelm had the attitudes of the young people of his day. Those who don't know sacrifice. Those who think that everything can be given to them for free because they've been spoiled. They've grown up in a society without war or struggle or depression or disease. They think that the fantasy world is truthful. So he began having dreams, delusions of grandeur. He believed that because Germany was so strong that it could snap its fingers and it could begin telling the world what to do. Because he believed, as this propaganda piece shows, that Germany, because it was so powerful, deserved its rightful place under the sun. That they were the leading European power, and thus they should be dominant globally. Which means a navy, colonies, conquest. So instead of diplomacy, he was prepared to use threats to achieve what is known as Weltpolitik. Welt is the German word for world. Politik is politics. Questions? All right, well, here's the thing. He wanted colonies, he wanted navies, he wanted global conquest, and Bismarck did not. Bismarck frequently warned him. Dude, you're going to do something dumb. You don't know what you're doing. You're a young kid. You're a moron. Don't be dumb. If you pursue these policies, you're going to end up in a situation where another country is coming in at the same time, and when you have two countries going into the same area, that could trigger a war. And guess what happens in war? There are no winners. People die. But the Kaiser didn't listen because he was young and he knew everything. Right? Young people know everything. So after trying for a year and a half, situations became so bad. They were fighting literally over all aspects of policy, domestic and foreign. Bismarck resigns. On March 18th, 1890, he handed to the Kaiser a letter of resignation, and he left the government after servicing the government of Germany and creating the government of Germany after 29 years. Which ironically was the same amount of time that he put into Germany as the Kaiser was when he became Kaiser. Questions? All right. Oh, here we go. This is what I was talking about. I knew I had a picture of it. See? Look how long his right arm is. But look what he's doing with his left arm. Right? Looks, he's on the pommel. It looks like his elbow should be bent. But look where his elbow is. It's not really bent at all. And look where his right hand is. And look where his left hand is. Notice, white glove. There's the pommel of the sword. You can't miss it now that you see it. So, now that he's in charge, Bismarck's out, how would he do? Well, let's just say almost every single historian that I've read on the subject largely believes that it was best described as being incoherent. It made absolutely no sense. There was no rhyme or reason. But of course, his rule was a reflection of the Kaiser himself. He was impatient. He wildly had outbursts whenever he didn't get what he wanted. He got angry quick. And he demanded complete allegiance. In truth, he wanted to rule. He wanted to be an absolute rule like the kings of old, where he could make the law and enforce the law. So he resented Bismarck's system, where the crown technically ruled, but it was the chancellor who had all the power. And to make matters worse, his presentation was bipolar. To the Germans, he was the symbol of nationalism, civic pride, because he encouraged advances in science, in medicine, in literature. He fully embraced German culture and German traditions. He was the epitome of what the average German believed greatness was. But have you ever seen a German give a speech? Ever see any documentaries like when Hitler was up at the podium giving a speech? There's something about the German language. It's very harsh. Yeah. It's just the way they pronounce their sounds, the syllables. So as the Kaiser is, say, talking about how wonderful it will be to expand literature, he's saying it in German, and it's coming out like, Ich bin ein Hüsager! Which caused all the people in Europe to say, oh my God, this guy's insane! But he also wasn't afraid to fire at the hip. So, not that I'm saying they are like in any way, but think about how people who are liberal react when, say, Trump sends a, well, he doesn't tweet anymore, whatever the Truth Social, whatever they call that. People lose their mind. Trump said, oh my God, they go crazy. Well, thing is, though, is the Kaiser kind of earned that reaction because he was abrupt, he was brash, he was bullish, militaristic. And he had no problem threatening to use military strength to get what he wanted. Which is the antithesis of what Bismarck had become. Bismarck was always talk first. Diplomacy. Let's have debates. Let's have discussion. Let's find compromise, consensus. But to make matters even worse, he fully believed in alles kommt von oben, which is German for everything comes from above. Alles, everything, kommt, comes, von, from, oben, above. That is the High Middle Ages attitude of divine rights of kings. He literally believed that it was God who put him on the throne, and therefore if you question him, you are questioning God. Which in a sense meant he was answerable to no one. Questions?
Well, truth be told, just because you inherit a job doesn't mean you're capable of doing it.
I have three friends that in my lifetime ran a business that they inherited into the ground because they had no idea how to run it after their parents retired. And to a degree, the Kaiser was the same thing. Wilhelm I did not control Germany's foreign policy. It was Bismarck. The Kaiser had full faith in his chancellor. But this man would take advice from nobody. He thought he knew what was right. So, instead of having people that would tell him no, or try giving him, you know, play devil's advocate, or multiple perspectives, he only surrounded himself with yes men. People who, no matter what he said, would be like, yeah, that's a great idea, that's awesome. And he constantly waved from one position to the next. You know, Bismarck seemingly was like that, but he always had his goal. But he engaged in redirection, so you could never see which angle he was coming at it from. The Kaiser didn't know where he wanted to go and was actually all over the place. So one day he would threaten war, and the next day he'd be like, no, let's see if we can negotiate. And then the following day, well, maybe we could buy it. I mean, it was just chaos. And then he would make a whole bunch of mistakes. And I'm going to give you four that ultimately would result in the complete destruction of Bismarck's alliance system. So, FYI, all of these would take place in a matter of a decade. So Bismarck worked for 29 years to prevent war, and the new Kaiser would undo it in a third of the time. Mistake number one. In 1890,
the reinsurance treaty expired. Bismarck had every intention of renewing it because Bismarck was trying to keep everyone in check.
Well, Wilhelm II did not care for the Russians. Now, the interesting thing is that the Tsar of Russia at this time, Nicholas II, was Wilhelm's cousin. But Wilhelm was also cousin with the King of England, because they had a common relative, Queen Victoria of England. So basically, this was kind of like a family feud. Willie couldn't stand Nikki, and he preferred Georgie. So the Kaiser believed if he shunned Russia, then he could make a closer bond with England. But that did not occur.
Well, when he did not get his way with England, he made a second mistake.
He began promising Austria full support. Now, by the way, remember what I said, what Bismarck told Austria. Fine, we'll make the dual alliance, defensive treaty. But off the record, he also told them that if Austria provoked a war, particularly in the Balkans, Germany's not getting involved. Well, Willie tells Franz Joseph's government, go for it. Be aggressive in the Balkans as you want, and we'll get you back. Now, Now, by the way, the Balkans was a great place because there was chaos there. There was no power, and to a degree it was a vacuum. The Ottoman Empire once controlled it, but we covered it. It was losing control and everything was falling apart. And all that was there was a bunch of tiny little states. So the Austrians, as we said, was in a survival of to the fittest, embraced the social Darwinist idea of you expand or you die. So they wanted to seize more and more land, which in the end causes Germany to basically say, you go for it. While simultaneously telling Italy, hey, why don't you get more aggressive in Africa? Believing that if we can strengthen the bonds between the three powers, that that would intimidate the other countries. Well, that was dumb. That was really dumb. Because when you have a group of people and you got a couple of them starting to act like knobs, that's usually going to turn off everybody else in the room. And in some instances, they might start pushing back. So instead of trying to intimidate, or rather, instead of accomplishing intimidation, all the Kaiser did was cause the other nations to begin basically saying, yeah, we don't like this.
Which would provide an opportunity to France to get an ally, which was also something Bismarck would have never allowed.
Within months after the reinsurance treaty expires, France jumps at the opportunity. France had become terrified that with the friendship of the Triple Alliance, that Germany might actually attack France. So France did not want to have to fight Germany by itself. The English hated the French, because everyone did. And the only other power on the continent was Russia. So even though France and Russia never really got along, the French kind of did, well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So, in 1881, they started trying to develop friendly relations with the Tsar's government. French bankers traveled to Russia and made investments in Russia. French factories, French industrialists, started making contracts to pay high prices for Russian goods. And soon the two countries started getting closer and closer into an alignment. They started having military exchanges where French officers would travel and watch Russian war games, and Russian officers would travel to France and watch French war games. France began selling weapons to Russia. Both started kind of saying, yeah, well, if something happens, I'll call you first. Eventually, this would result in the formation of an alliance.
France and Russia would work out a deal.
But this deal, while defensive in nature, had a little more teeth to it. So I'll put it on the board. They're working on the alarms. better check.
The last thing I want you to do is I'll burn to death.
I know they're working on the alarms, but is this a test? You're not gonna die. Good news.
Alright. That's interesting. Crap, I lost track of my train of thought and I was gonna try to get us done. Get your brain back, Lamanic. Alright, here we go. Now, because we have two nations involved, this dual alliance would be a little more tricky. So, if France is attacked by either Germany or Italy, then Russia attacks Germany. So again, defensive treaty. If France is attacked by either or, then Russia attacks Germany. Why not attack Italy? Russia can't get to Italy. It's called geography. Similarly, if Russia is attacked by either Germany or Austria, then France attacks Germany. So now we have a deadly situation for Germany. If a war erupts, even if they're not involved, they're going to be attacked. And they're not just going to be attacked from one side. You're going to have to fight a two-front war. And this, my friends, is Bismarck's worst nightmare. Because historically speaking, there has never been a war where a nation was attacked on two fronts that they won. If two nations attacking you, you always lose. Questions?
All right, then let's finish this up and give you the fourth mistake.
Splendid isolationism. Germany and its aggression would, for the first time, like I said, since 1822, would freak out England enough to start paying attention to what was going on in the continent. Because Germany contended it was going to go global. And who has global domination? England.
Now, interestingly enough, what inspired the Kaiser was a book written by an American,
Alfred Thayer Mahan, in 1882, 1883, I can't remember the exact year, would write arguably one of the most influential books on naval strategy called Influence of Sea Power Upon History. Mahan would analyze world events from 1660 all the way up until 1783. And he recognized that one of the strongest factors in nations winning wars was naval power. Nations that had strong navies could blockade other nations, severing imports, exports, plus could muster resources to strengthen the attack. He also envisioned, like, epic, large-scale naval battles. Fleets of dozens of ships clashing on the seas. So he essentially argues that to be a great power, you must have a great navy.
Which, of course, was the exact opposite of what Bismarck thought. Bismarck did not want the government to have to take tax dollars to build military vessels.
Instead, he advocated for commerce. So instead of having a navy fight, let your businesses go over. Let your businesses make contracts with the different areas in the world. Let your businesses buy those goods, sell those goods, engage in capitalism.
Because they'll have to pay for the ships. They'll get profit, but they'll also have to cover the losses.
And at the end of the day, everything that comes into your country from abroad can be taxed. Which is good for the economy. And it doesn't cause a drain. Fortunately, the Kaiser dreamed of having a powerful navy.
So much so, before Germany even had a navy, within the first year of his reign, he had this portrait painted of him
in a Navy officer's uniform because he loved the idea. I mean, after all, I don't know if the girl, I'm not going to knock you ladies. I don't know how ladies think. I'm not a lady. But I know when I was a little boy and I was in the bathtub, I had all my little boats that I liked playing with, or when I went into the pool or in the ocean, and I would always conduct naval battles. Every now and then, somehow, one of the boats would learn how to fly and come down in like a kamikaze strike. Well, I'm sure he did the same thing. And when he became Kaiser, he wanted the big boats. So, he desires a navy to be able to compete with Britain. So that way, instead of letting German companies go in, he wanted to be able to send in German battleships and scare England. Because he wanted to show Georgie who was the most powerful ruler.
So in charge of this, he would put his Grand Admiral, Admiral Alfred von Tirpitz,
who would, in the 1890s and into the 1910s, essentially would create Germany's naval policy. And Germany's naval policy is pretty straightforward. He would build a strong navy, and he would use that navy like a club. His goal was to create the world's second largest naval force. And with that, Germany could go global and flex its muscles. And it would intimidate England. Because England would never attack Germany's navy because of the cost of building battleships, the loss of blood, the loss of treasure. Plus, Tirpitz reasoned, if England tries fighting Germany and England loses ships, it's not going to be able to control its empire. So England will give in, and Germany can become strong. questions? Don't have enough time to do what's next, so we will leave it here.
Because after all, the fire alarm was a scare.
Papers, papers, papers. Time is running short, April 26th. If you haven't gotten them done yet, get them done. Get them into the Dropbox, but make sure you check profromantic.com. Don't make any stupid mistakes. Don't allow your B paper to become a D paper, because that's just dumb.
Of course, if you have any questions, don't be afraid to ask or send me an email. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll see y'all on Tuesday.